The Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. The first bill on the agenda today is Senate File 2833, Senator Michelle.
Dave tells me Senator Lizzie sent me.
Good morning. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 2833 is the Abigail Taylor Pool Safety Act, and I'm very sad to say that since this bill was heard in the Policy Committee, Abigail Taylor passed away down in Omaha, Nebraska, where she was trying to recover from her injuries and an organ transplant that the family went through. So it's been a rough couple weeks for the Taylor family. So this bill, Madam Chair, is intended to make sure this kind of incident never happens again in Minnesota. We have kind of used as the foundation for this bill federal legislation that was passed this year. Thanks to Senator Klobuchar and Representative Ramstead. Members, we know what can make pools safe. We know what drain covers work. We know what kind of drain systems are safe. This legislation would allow the Department of Health to oversee more public pools in the state of Minnesota. We want to require certification every year that these pools meet these safety requirements. We want to require a daily physical inspection of things like the drains, again, to make sure that this kind of an incident never happens again. Madam Chair, we believe that some pools will need to be retrofit, particularly some of the older pools. And what we want to do is phase that in over time, beginning with the wading pools, or what many people just refer to as kiddie pools. Those are the pools where these kind of incidents, eviscerations have occurred. That is what happened with Abigail Taylor, and that's the kind of pool we want to focus on first. And we want to start now, Madam Chair, and be ready for the upcoming swimming season. So with that, Madam Chair, with your agreement, I have the A9, and I'd also like to ask Mr. Stein from the Health Department to describe what we're doing with this amendment.
Madam Chair, I would move
the A9 amendment. Senator Coring has moved the A9 amendment. Mr. Stein, do you want to explain the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Link Stein. I'm the Director of Environmental Health for the Minnesota Department of Health. The amendment provides some technical corrections and revisions to the original language to clarify a few things. First of all, it adds title to the legislation. It also then on lines 1.10, 1.15, inserts a gravity outlet or drain. A gravity outlet or drain is a safe form of outlet design for a swimming pool. The primary concern over outlet designs pertains to suction outlet systems, that system in which a pump is used to provide for the drainage of the pool. Gravity drain outlets are commonly used in larger swimming pools, high schools, and many of the public swimming pools around the Twin Cities are provided with gravity drains, in which case the drainage from the pool goes to a tank, and the tank then has a pump on it that provides for the drain outlet. So there's not the suction that can be created under that drain system is significantly less than systems where there's a pump used to provide for the drainage. And those then are included in sections of the bill which are not required to be retrofitted. If they have a gravity drain, pools will not be required to be retrofitted. Secondly, on lines 1.17 to 1.20, there's an amendment that describes what happens during an inspection if there's a grate or a cover of an outlet is missing, has not been replaced. This allows for the grate to be replaced if it was simply loose, not damaged in any way. Everything's fine with the actual equipment. They can reattach that equipment to the drain and comply with the law. Then there are some technical corrections. And then Section 8 of the original bill is amended to, starting at lines 1.3 of the amendment, to address inspections and inspection frequency that the department has for public pools, as well as risk categories starting at lines 2.1 and forward. Those are that's existing law in Chapter 157 that gives us direction in terms of the frequency of inspections and risks that are associated with those, so that we clarify the existing language of the statute. So they're primarily technical corrections to the bill. I failed to point out, Madam Chair and members, on line 1.11, one of the provisions of the bill that's modified is the date that's moved back for compliance with retrofitting for the drain requirements from 2010 to 2011. That allows for the deeper pools to have an additional year to comply if they have suction outlets. They will get one added year to retrofit those pools.
Are there any questions on the amendment? Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, this is not on the amendment. It's on the fiscal note. Can I ask that now? Or?
Well, let's get the amendment taken care of first. Any questions on the amendment? I guess I have one question, and that is in regard to the wading pools. I understand that there are three in Minneapolis that would have to be modified under this bill, and my understanding is that the Park Board does not have anything budgeted to repair those pools. It would be about $5,000 a piece. And so I assume that would mean, if this bill passes, that those pools would not be used until somehow, somewhere, sometime, they would be able to budget the money to install the new type of drain.
Madam Chair, we've had conversations with the city and with the Park Board, and we're aware of that concern. They haven't indicated to the department what their plans would be for those pools, but I think your statement is accurate. If they don't have the resources to make the changes to the pool drain systems, the other option available to them is not open those pools.
Well, these are outdoor pools, so it's not exactly like, I mean, you have a pool there, you just don't have any water in it.
Madam Chair, I could also just clarify that the law allows them to comply by January 1 of 2009, so it would take effect, if you will, for those outdoor pools in the 2009 open water season. So they're not precluded from opening those pools during 2008, but there would be a requirement by January 1, 2009 to comply.
So we would have wading pools this summer, but not next summer.
Madam Chair, presuming that you're correct, that they don't have the resources to make the changes, that's correct.
Well, my understanding is that they have months out of the year when the parks are closed in Minneapolis, you know.
And Madam Chair, if I may, the intent with the wading pools, again, that is the those kind of pools, an older wading pool, that's the red flag. That is where these kind of incidents have occurred. So we want to take care of the wading pools first. What we did was we tried to line up the effective date of the state requirements with the effective date of the federal requirements. The federal legislation becomes effective at the end of 08. So no matter where you are, if you have a public pool, you're going to need to begin complying with these federal regulations this year.
Senator Michelle, my understanding of your bill is to make the standards tougher than the federal standards. Therefore, more costly to change the pools.
And, Madam Chair, what would begin immediately would be requirements like the physical inspection. Mm-hmm. So we understand that the retrofitting of some of these pools is going to take some time. Pool owners and operators are going to have to figure out, do we comply with the feds? Do we comply with the state? They're going to need to find people who can do this kind of work. So we can't just instantly turn on a switch. And so we understand that. Again, the intent is to take care of these kiddie pools first.
Is there someone here from Minneapolis? And of course, this doesn't just affect Minneapolis, but there are a number of cities around the state that have free pools as a part of their park system.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Peterson with Bryce Michaels and Walter, representing the Minneapolis Park Board. Madam Chair, you're correct. I do want to say thank you to Senator Michelle and to the Department of Health. They've been very good in addressing our other concerns, specifically with adding the gravity drain language, which is what the vast majority of our pools use. We do have three pools that do not meet these standards. We are getting estimates on what it would cost to repair those at this time. It could be $5,000, it could be $15,000 a pool. We just don't know yet. And we do not have that in our budget at this time to construct it either this year or before it opens in 2009.
So would it be your intention, if this bill passes then, to just not open those pools in 2009?
Madam Chair, we're reviewing our options. That would be one option. If there are other funds that can be shifted around, we're looking at that. Obviously, these are a big amenity in the city of Minneapolis. The wading pools have thousands and thousands of users every summer. To have our residents go without those would be a big hit to the system. So that would not be our preferable course, but if we don't have the budget, it is an option.
Shut it down.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I know that it's a tough decision, but it seems to me that the safety of the child is of greater concern, and that it would be better to close the pool than not to have the appropriate safety mechanisms there.
Well, I guess the real question, Senator Prettner-Solon, is whether these pools are endangering the children in Minneapolis, or whether this level of this toughness needs, if the standard is appropriate, I guess.
Madam Chair, do we have an opinion about that? Because I know that other cities will be facing the same issue.
Mm-hmm. I know they will.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, as far as our records show, we have never had a safety issue in any of our wading pools, at least not to this degree. Obviously, what happened is a tragedy. We need to do everything we can to avoid that, but our pools have extremely high safety records. As far as we can tell, we've never had an entrapment issue or anything to that effect. And the research that I've done indicate that from what I can see, all or at least most of the major accidents have happened in private pool systems, not in government-run or park-owned facilities. Again, we don't have any opposition to the House language, which moves the dates back. But for the 09 season, this would be a burden for the Minneapolis Park Board and for a lot of other cities across the state.
Thank you.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Michelle, this is perhaps a question for you. Since you're carrying the bill and probably have a pretty good idea of the statewide picture, but also you're a lawyer, and I'm wondering two things. How many pools are affected statewide? And then secondly, if the legislature has already determined that this is a hazard, and we are on the cusp of passing a bill having to do with the fact that we acknowledge these drains are a danger. And then there's a one-year gap between when we require them to be installed and those pools are still in use. And if there's an injury, is there, you know, it seems to me that we put ourselves in a more risky situation during that 1 year. And you as a lawyer, I'm sure, might argue that, but I don't know. Would the legal bar be easier to reach, or would parks or pool operators be more at risk?
Well, and Madam Chair and Senator Erickson Ropes, I think I'll refrain from any legal opinions on this. My opinions as a state senator are probably bad enough. but a couple general comments, and then Mr. Stein can talk about the number of pools that we know about or are potentially affected. We know that on June 30th of 2007, the day after Abigail Taylor was hurt, this was a very well-publicized event. And our at least anecdotal evidence is that literally every pool operator in the state got in their pools to make sure that they were safe. So Minnesotans have been in some way or another on notice since last June. Again, the feds passed their legislation, which becomes effective at the end of this year. I mean, I think part of it is just a recognition that you can't flip a switch. You can't get all this work done. And that goes to the first part of your question, is, well, how much work will there be? And I think at this point we're just getting that inventory of pools, and I'll ask Mr. Stein to follow up on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, the numbers are very difficult to come by because there's not a thorough inventory of public swimming pools in the state yet. One of the issues that we seek to rectify with this bill is to assure that all pools that are available for public use are licensed and inspected by government. The department currently delegates authority to a number of local units of government who license and inspect swimming pools associated with food, beverage, and lodging facilities, and then local governments may add to that inspection and licensing requirement on their own. The state's role currently is limited to licensing of swimming pools at licensed food, beverage, and lodging facilities. This bill will expand the number of pools subject to licensure in the state to all publicly available swimming pools and spas, and that we estimate will expand the number that are regulated by the state by about 500 to 700 pools. Local governments are currently licensing these if they have a licensing inspection program. Total number of pools statewide, we estimate somewhere around 4,000 pools. We think that there are about, of these type of pools, that does not include residential, private residential pools. I want to be clear on that. We're only talking about pools that are at health clubs, YMCAs, community centers, residential housing complexes, apartment buildings, condominiums, et cetera.
High schools?
High schools are all included. Those that are currently licensed and inspected by the state or local unit of government, we estimate are somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000. So there's somewhere between 500 and 1,500 that are going to be licensed that are not currently licensed by our estimates. I would say that, as I pointed out previously, we're currently at a bit of a gap in terms of our knowledge specifically of the numbers, but that's our current estimates.
Well, and I don't really lose any sleep over these regulations or the inspection requirements for private pools because they charge people to use them. And so if they have an additional cost, they have a way to recover that cost. But for our public pools, ones in our high schools, the ones in our public parks, I do worry about this bill in relationship to those, because I know that my community is not the only one that will be hard-pressed to meet these requirements. And I do not lose any sleep thinking about the three waiting pools in Minneapolis that are affected being dangerous. So they're not dangerous pools. So then I think, I don't know exactly all what is in here, but I think either there's we're going overboard here, or, you know, there should be some kind of exemption for those types of pools, or there should be some state funding to help bring them into compliance. One of those should be able to happen.
And, Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
I think one of the tensions we've been trying to balance here is that I guess we fall on the side of preferring one standard for all pools. So we have not distinguished between private and public or those owned or if there's a fee involved. But we have a better idea now of what is safe and what is not safe and what makes sense. And so the thought with the Department of Health and certainly me as the author is that we would have one standard that all would comply with no matter where you're swimming.
Madam Chair.
Well, we don't exactly have one standard in terms of affordability of swimming pools around the state. Senator Pretner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, I'm wondering if there isn't a different standard, though, than what is presented in the bill. If there are public pools that are safe, could not that same standard be applied to the private pools rather than requiring every pool in the state to change the type of caps or safety mechanisms they're using?
Madam Chair, Senator Solon, I'm not sure I understand.
Well, maybe I don't
understand.
Well, it isn't just changing the caps in these pools that are going to cost $5,000 to $15,000. It's not just replacing a cover. It's yeah, digging out the whole pool and changing the drainage system for the pool. Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, I'm not sure what the answer is, but I'm pretty sure that if my child is swimming in a pool in Minnesota, that I'm committed to having the same standard in one pool, in one community versus another versus public or private. And I'm trying to be cognizant of the financial implications here, but overall in the scope of things, I sort of keep coming back to the Taylor family. I don't know the Taylor family. We are talking about a relatively small amount of investment to ensure that this never happens again. And so I wonder if the department sees this as a matter of public safety. And if so, how we might step forward in that regard.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Stein.
Senator Lynch, the department did, upon the inquiries related to the legislation and the scope of our existing law, we asked our local units of government that are currently delegated authority to license and inspect pools. We also asked manufacturers and owners of pools what their opinion would be. We surveyed other states to look at what standards exist and what would be protective of public health and safety. The standards that are recommended in this bill include where there is a suction outlet, and that means there is the pump driving the drainage system such that the water moves, the pump runs, and things are drawn to the pump through the drainage system. Okay, that is the source of public safety concern, because if there's a problem with an outlet or an outlet cover being placed incorrectly, missing, or otherwise defective, you can have suction hazards created. There have been a number of accidents across the country over the years, almost all related to suction outlet systems. And so in the opinion of the people we surveyed and of our own staff and engineers, the standard that we're recommending is protective of public health and safety. It requires a second drain line to be installed in parallel with that first drain line, such that it would be difficult to have both drains plugged at the same time, so that you couldn't have all the suction coming through one line. That's the standard that exists in Michigan. It has existed in Michigan since 1971, and it is a standard that we're recommending Minnesota public swimming pools meet. It is, in our opinion...
Mr. Stein, is this a department bill?
Madam Chair, this is not the department's bill. This was, the governor did sponsor a bill. This is actually a modification of the department's original language.
If the department sponsored a bill, why did it not show up in the governor's budget?
Madam Chair, the department sponsored language, which then did not advance in the governor's proposal. This bill was moving in the Senate at that time.
Okay, well, let's...
I'm sorry.
Is there any other discussion of the A-9 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, I have a question on the fiscal note, $210,000. So is that all fees, or is
special
that
special revenue? It's increasing fees that would be paid by the owners of pools to have their pools inspected more frequently.
So, Madam Chair, so it's all fee. Paid for by fees, no general fund dollars at all.
That's right.
Yep. Madam Chair and Senator Coring, that the intent is that this is a internally funded piece of legislation, and I know there's been a couple questions about the fiscal note that I'd asked Mr. Stein to address, just to make sure we're clear on that.
Madam Chair, and Senator Coring, the fiscal note shows a $19,000 cost that's not covered to the state. The initial estimate of numbers of pools was the basis for $191,000 in revenue. We, at the time, estimated a cost of $198,000 to the department. That failed to include some of the indirect charges that the department incurs. So that's why the difference now at $210,000. Having said that, we know that the revenue estimates are going to depend upon our inventory of pools and what's actually licensed, and so we're comfortable addressing this through revenue collection and absorb the additional costs that may be there.
And then, Madam Chair, a couple more questions.
Senator Coring.
And this is a question I see somebody from the department here. Is there a pool inspector now that works for the health department? And if there isn't, does that mean that this is another additional hiring of somebody else to be the pool inspector?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, yes, our pool inspector, Mr. Steve Clem, is sitting right there in the blue fleece vest, and he is currently our sole swimming pool inspector. This bill would fund two additional public health sanitarians to assist in the review of plans, inspections of pools, and licensing of pools.
And then, Madam Chair, if I could ask another question. So we have a pool inspector. So is there a statute that says pools need to be inspected every other year, every 5 years, every 10 years, or how does that all work? And, you know, if we have an inspector, why wasn't this being done before?
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, the incident in St. Louis Park, let me address that because that was a, I think your question partly takes off of that incident. Am I correct?
Yeah.
The city of St. Louis Park is delegated the authority to license and inspect swimming pools. They did inspect the Minneapolis Golf Club swimming pool prior to its opening in 2007. They inspect every year. And there is a statute in Chapter 157 that prescribes the frequency of pool inspections. So there was an inspection made of the Minneapolis Golf Course Club pool, as well as all other currently licensed pools are inspected on a regular basis by the department or by the local units of government that are delegated the program.
And, Madam Chair, I guess I kind of find it if we're going to start having fees now and we have one pool inspector and 3,000 pools, I don't know how physically that this gentleman is going to be able to inspect every single pool.
Madam Chair and Senator Cording, we currently collect fees to support our current program. We're expanding the number of pools that will be licensed and inspected. We will add staff to add the licensing and inspection of those additional pools.
How many pools will be inspected through this bill that are not currently being inspected?
Madam Chair, we estimate the number to be somewhere between 500 and 700 additional pools by the department. Then there will be additional pools inspected by local units of government that are delegated the program.
And they would be paying anywhere from $110 to $150 inspection fee annually?
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct. I'd have to go back and verify the pool.
$110 to $180, I guess it is.
I think that's correct. $180 is the maximum for the annual inspection.
And do you know how many of these 500 to 600 new pool inspections would be public pools versus private pools?
Madam Chair, if your question is how many are owned by, like, multifamily housing associations or versus parks or local government owned pools, is that your question? We do not have an estimate of that number at this time.
So, there any other
if
questions?
I could just ask another question,
Senator Cording.
The pool that we're talking about, so that pool was never inspected or just never had a reason to be inspected or what? Tell me a little bit about that.
Madam Chair and Senator Cording, the pool was inspected. It was inspected annually by the city of St. Louis Park.
Okay, then, Madam Chair, so then why did this happen then?
Madam Chair, Senator Cording, the one of the reasons was that the drain system was defective. The cover was missing on the day of the incident. And that meant that the suction line was open directly to the bottom of the pool. What happened was Abby Taylor, unfortunately, became seated on that drain. The suction from the drain line caused her to be eviscerated. How that happens is there were problems with the... Based on our investigation that we've conducted, it appears that there were problems associated with the operator and owner of the pool. There were also problems with the drain system that was a responsibility of the owner and operator of the pool. The City of St. Louis Park's inspection, based on what they found the day they inspected, which was mid to late May 2007, found that the drain cover was in place and that the pool drain system was operating correctly. So between the date of the accident, which occurred in late June, and the time that it was inspected, something happened with the drain cover and the drain system.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess that really concerns me because if we're adding on all these inspectors and we're inspecting, but yet this is going to happen anyway, I guess I'm kind of troubled by that.
Madam Chair and Senator Cording, maybe this will
Senator Michelle
help a little bit. In addition to any new equipment or design that we would require, this bill also calls for a daily inspection. So if by the owner and the operator.
The owner of the pool would do a daily inspection.
So if I'm going to the Coring public pool, you're going to have to work with the Department of Health and certify that on a daily basis you are inspecting that pool and those drains. Mm-hmm. That's different. Okay. That's new.
And probably the most important part of the bill. Any other questions on the fiscal note? Any other questions on the bill?
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Perhaps, Senator Michelle, could you tell us, has the federal law passed?
Yes.
And what difference is there between this and the federal law that seems important for our state?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, the federal law passed in December of 07. It becomes effective a year after its passage, so in December of 08, the federal standards kick in. I would say that the biggest difference, I asked Mr. Stein to comment as well, but the biggest difference is we require the state, through this legislation, would require this physical daily inspection.
Okay.
The feds do not have that in.
Mr. Stein.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, the other difference is the federal law allows a owner to install, first of all, requires a conforming drain cover of a newer standard. That's a requirement that the drain covers be improved and meet an additional standard, which this bill also addresses. Secondly, it requires that the owner operator of a pool, whether that's public, private, any pool, install a secondary system to break the suction on any pumped or suction outlet systems. That those systems increase safety by reducing entrapment, your clothing, your hair, your limbs getting attached or drawn into a suction line. That shutoff valve, though, has to know that there's, in order for the shutoff switch to kick in, it requires that the suction be broken for a period of time, and then it will shut off. So eviscerating types of injuries are not prevented by that shutoff system.
So,
but Mr. Stein, the federal law does not require all pools to have a secondary drainage system.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And that is what causes the large expense to pools in the bill, as I understand it. Just replacing the drain covers with safer drain covers is not a very expensive proposition.
Madam Chair, the estimate of cost to comply with the federal law to install a compliant cover means breaking the concrete in the bottom of the pool, installing a correct mounting ring, and a new drain cover. We estimate the cost of that to be $500 to $1,000 per cover.
Madam,
right, but that's not $5,000 to $15,000 per pool.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
And that actually was what I was getting at, and I was wondering if the language could be changed to allow all of those things that come in compliance with the federal law as well as the daily inspection, but that instead of requiring all existing pools, unless they are found to be defective, to have to put in that second drain, if instead we could put in a requirement that future pools had to have the second drain.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, you certainly could go in that direction, but again, I'd be worried that we then have pools of varying safety levels throughout the state. This kind of I have trouble saying the word evisceration, this has happened in kiddie pools and in older kiddie pools. If your community was building a new pool today, I'm certain it would meet all these standards. It's the industry standard now, but it's these older pools that maybe have not gotten as much attention in the past that I think we should be most concerned about and need to act the quickest upon.
But again, Madam Chair, if daily inspections are being done, isn't it likely that that would be noted and that corrections would be made before a problem occurred? And Madam Chair, I'm wondering if we could have an amendment drafted to, or the intention anyways of that amendment drafted.
Well, we can lay the bill aside so that work can be done on amendment if you want to offer one.
Okay.
We'll just take a break from your bill so the amendment can be drafted.
Madam Chair, I've got another amendment that could chew up a few minutes, might provide enough time to get one done. We can set it aside, too, and I'll return to mine. But I do have one to take up it before we're done.
All right. Well, let's move on to Senate File 1520. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Before
you begin, Senator, I wanted just to announce that this bill has been through policy committees. I don't know how many, but quite a few. And the purpose of the hearing here is to address the fiscal note. And so we are going to limit testimony on the bill in terms of the proponents and opponents to 10 minutes each.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1520 is about naturopathic practice regulations and the establishment of a registry. As you stated, Madam Chair, the reason we are before your committee is only to address the fiscal note related to this particular bill, which is related to the fees that are paid to the medical board of practice. And for members, we went through the policy committee, and also we went through judiciary to address some of the issues, and we have had really ample opportunity to communicate to different constituency groups about what we're trying to pursue. And just to clarify, to let you know that this particular bill does not intend to establish a licensing process for this area of practice. This is not intending to move in that direction. I am hoping and I believe that this will be pursued in the future, that this group of doctors will pursue licensing in the future. But this particular bill is only to establish a registry that will give consumers who are actively seeking greater choice from a broader range of effective and highly trained health provider access to preventive and wellness care that has been shown to reduce the rates of illness and chronic disease. As you probably know, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is an area of practice that is growing. More and more people in the public are pursuing naturopathic treatment. And what this particular group of doctors want to do is really give the public an opportunity to see what kind of training they have received, so that if you are looking for treatment in this area, you can go to that registry and obtain that information. That's all this bill will do. I also want to make absolutely clear to all of you and to the members of the public who are here that these current bill will not change anything in the daily practice or the current practice that is under Chapter 146A, which has been in place for many, many years. We do not intend to change the language in that chapter. The practice will continue to go the way it is. This is a very limited provision to give this particular group of practitioners an ability to register. That's all there is not a license process. And I, Madam Chair, I neglected to as you stated at the beginning, there are many people, many of them are in the audience today, who requested that I move an amendment of their, on their behalf, because the language that we offered that passed both the Judiciary Committee and the Policy Committee did not agree with the language that we had. They offer an amendment, which I accepted. When I presented this amendment to the group that has been pursuing this piece of legislation, they had some concerns. So our staff, and I want to publicly thank Ms. Kavanaugh for all of the work that she's done on this, went through this language that was proposed by people who opposed the original language. She read all of the concerns that other people had, and she came up with this particular proposal, which I understand takes care of the concerns of both groups, and that is the A9 amendment, Madam Chair and members, that I would like to ask you to move for me.
Well, Senator Sharon moves the A9 amendment. So this is to clean up previous amendments that were made in error?
That is correct, Madam Chair. Not so much in error, but I think there was some technicalities on the language, a misunderstanding as to, you know, what this bill will do to 146A. So we wanted to make absolutely clear, you know, with the use of this language, and as you see, these are very specific words that we want to make sure are clearly stated in this legislation.
And then, of course, it does have the appropriation in it, which is necessary.
Correct, Madam Chair. That's the other piece that it was included, and it needs to be part of the new language that will move to the next committee.
So any discussion or question about the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A9 amendment is adopted. And let's look at the fiscal note for a minute. There are 26 of these folks right now that would be eligible to be placed on this registry, and the bill calls for an initial $200 fee with an annual fee after that of $150, and that would cover the cost to the board for administering this registry. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions about the fiscal note? Okay. Any questions about the bill? Okay, then we will take 10 minutes of testimony on each side.
Madam Chair, we will be happy to testify. The proponents are here to answer questions, but if the committee would like to hear testimony from one of the doctors.
Well, I had said we would give each side 10 minutes. If you want to waive your 10 minutes, that's fine. Whatever you want to do.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Leslie Walensky. I have a bachelor's degree from the College of St. Catherine. I am trained as a naturopathic doctor and am the current president of the Minnesota Association of Naturopathic Physicians. I represent our 26 members here today. Each of us have four years of an undergraduate education and 4 years of graduate-level residential naturopathic medical school, including 3 years of supervised clinical training in one of 6 North American naturopathic medical schools recognized by a body of the U.S. Department of Education. These schools are located in Washington, Oregon, Arizona, Connecticut, British Columbia, and Ontario. Naturopathic medical education includes a standard medical curriculum encompassing all of the biomedical sciences, along with clinical nutrition, herbal medicine, physical medicine, and lifestyle counseling. We have also passed national board exams. I currently hold a license to practice naturopathic medicine in Washington State, one of 14 states that license naturopathic doctors, where naturopathic doctors practice in the primary care arena. Although Minnesota does not currently regulate the practice of naturopathic medicine, I continue to maintain my Washington license through continuing education requirements as mandated by Washington state law, requiring 25 credit hours each year. I am here today to ask you to support the registration of naturopathic doctors in Minnesota. Registration of naturopathic doctors will protect the public by providing proper oversight and ensure comprehensive, competent natural health care as expected by healthcare consumers in Minnesota. We have worked amicably with the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice for over 10 years, and if registered, we will fall under their jurisdiction. By elevating Minnesota to a federally recognized level of standards, you help improve access to quality alternative health care. It is not our intent to prohibit the practice of other health care practitioners in Minnesota. All of the unlicensed CAM and natural health practitioners currently have a legal right to practice under Minnesota Statute 146A, and anyone who can afford to pay them for their services has the freedom to access them. These freedoms will not change due to the registration of naturopathic medicine in Minnesota, because the proposed legislation does not repeal or annul that law. There will still be unlicensed CAM providers, and they will still be protected under Minnesota Statute 146A. At this time, briefly, I'd like to have you refer to a handout you should have before you. This is written by the president of one of our naturopathic medical schools. He was in town last week to testify for us and didn't have the opportunity. But I just wanted to refer to a couple of the statements that he has written on this page. David Schleich is his name. He's the president of National College of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon, one of the six accredited naturopathic medical schools in North America. So under number one, he says, NCNM, which is National College of Natural Medicine, is a postgraduate medical institution accredited by the Department of Education in Washington, D.C. We have 500 graduate medical students in our ND programs, naturopathic medicine, and classical Chinese medicine. I am proud to mention we are also listed in the Princeton Review among the top 168 medical schools in the nation. In addition to our two on-campus clinics, we provide award-winning clinical services to 14 Portland community clinics for a total supervised clinical patient base of approximately 40,000 patient visits per year. NCNM is also the home of the Hefgott Research Institute, whose repertoire of studies includes six grants from the NIH, the most recent being $766,000. Students of NCNM are supported by Stafford and Title IV federal student loans, as well as state-based student loan programs. Students of NCNM also participate in the Federal Schools Lender Program, with 100% of fees recycled to student bursaries. And just a couple of other points. Number two, the faculty profile at our accredited naturopathic schools. Basic sciences faculty are PhDs from accredited universities in the key basic sciences disciplines. Naturopathic clinical faculty are graduates, international accredited naturopathic medical colleges with a minimum of 10 years of successful licensed clinical practice. The staff complement also includes several American-trained medical doctors, MDs. Number three, the application process for NCNM follows the standards required by the U.S. Department of Education. Acceptance ratios are in concert with post-secondary applicant pools for professional medical programs. That is, one of three applicants may be accepted normally. So thank you for the opportunity to share that. And again, we thank you very much for your time, and we thank you in advance for your consideration and your support.
Are there any questions? I guess not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Mahan.
Hi, I'm Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Bill Manahan, a medical doctor. Just to say a little bit about myself, for 10 years in the mid-70s to mid-80s, I was on the clinical faculty at Mayo Medical School, and I was a medical director for 5 years in Mankato of the hospital there, which is now a Mayo facility. For 15 years, I have been on the faculty here at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Family Practice. I was the founding program director for Minnesota's first rural family practice residency in Waseca and Mankato, which was legislated by this body to get rural physicians. And so I bring that up because I'm grounded in and knowledgeable about and very thankful for Western allopathic medicine. On the national level, I've been president of the American Holistic Medical Association. I've written a book on nutrition that sold quite a few. And I've worked with natural healers for about 35 or 40 years. So I'm grounded in and knowledgeable about and very supportive of natural healing. And in fact, I find it rather disconcerting that I think for the last 40 years I've been the biggest backer in, if not the United States, in Minnesota of all the natural healers. And if I have to tell you my truth, I don't think anybody should be licensed in a perfect world. And we all should be able to do what we, in our best spirit, can do. But in fact, we're not in a perfect world, so we do have licensure. And we license based on the amount of education and the amount of schooling and the amount of accreditation. And it feels to me that's what this is about. I'm caught between a community of natural healers that I'm absolutely for, and yet I find myself here on the opposite side of the aisle for some strange reason, which I still can't figure out. There's some opposition to what seems to me pretty simple about licensing the 4-year degree postgraduate school naturopathic physicians. Because of being involved in over 100,000 patient visits during my years of practice, I developed an appreciation for the wonderful things Western medicine can do to help people. Interestingly, the longer I practiced, the more I realized some of my patients with complex medical problems were not adequately taken care of by my medical colleagues or by me. Therefore, during the decade of the 1980s, during a center that I started called the Wellness Center of Minnesota, one of the first integrative centers in the United States in Mankato, of which Senator Sharon knows it well, I developed an appreciation for the wonderful things that Western medicine – oh, excuse me. Anyway, during those years, I had a naturopathic physician working with me in my office in Mankato one day a week. And during those years, my patients and I developed a profound appreciation for the power of the complementary approaches to healthcare and the many benefits to patients of a collaborative approach. I found that working alongside a naturopathic doctor resulted in major health improvements for my patients, whether it was asthma, migraine, arthritis, irritable bowel, or many other problems. My patients and I appreciated the expanded scope of modalities and ideas with which to treat these complicated problems. So for the best medical care of my patients, I find I must send them to medical subspecialists such as cardiologists, surgeons, and others. In the same matter, for my patients' best medical care, I must also send them to fully qualified naturopathic doctors to help them get better. That does not eliminate the use that sometimes I send them to other natural healers, but it's also important for me to know who has gone through a certain level of training and who I send certain people to. In my opinion, an important step in solving our present healthcare crisis would be to have NDs, naturopathic doctors, and MDs, medical doctors, and ODOs, osteopathic doctors, working together in every single medical office in Minnesota. I do not believe registration of the naturopathic physicians will in any way affect the hundreds of my friends, the natural healers in Minnesota, presently practicing. I think the 146A bill, which you so beautifully passed some years ago, takes care of that and continues to provide the necessary protection. Therefore, I strongly support the registration of naturopathic doctors in Minnesota. Thank you.
Are there any questions? I don't see any. You have about one more minute if you have any more testimony.
Fine. Thank you.
All right. Then, Senator Torres-Ray, we will go to the opponents to testify, and I'll call Katie Murphy.
Senator,
we'll have 10 minutes for the opponents as well.
I think most,
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, most members of the policy committee receive a letter from the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice that supports this, but I'm going to distribute that if the staff could distribute it to the members.
That would be fine.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Sharon?
I just, while the testifiers are coming up, I'd also like to add for the information of this committee that Dr. William Manahan, besides all of the other important roles that he's played, is the person who started the Open Door Healthcare Clinic in Mankato area. and started it as a free clinic with all volunteer systems in place, and it's now a substantially impressive organization in our region.
Well, our congratulations to him for that good work. We'll take Katie Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing my testimony today or input. My name is Katie Murphy, and I'm Minnesota home and grown. I have two clinics in the Twin Cities area, one in Woodbury and one in Bloomington, called Healing Insights Natural Health Care Incorporated. We see about 65 to 100 new people that have never done our therapies before each month, and introduce them to our therapies, which include cranial sacral, aromatherapy, and our specialty, which is colonics or colon hydrotherapy, a little known area of expertise but growing. I am, if you were to talk with peers, considered to be one of the most knowledgeable experts in the field of colon hydrotherapy. I now hold a contract for the sale of colon hydrotherapy equipment from the largest manufacturer of the equipment to all of the United States for clinical and medical introduction and training of medical staff to perform the services. I've been in the business for about 15 years and am very excited about the future opportunity of natural health care and, of natural health care and the opportunity to provide it on a more intelligent, informed basis to the entire community. I recently kind of came upon information about this bill as early as just this last week. I am not associated with the people from who have been working with the amendments and the nonprofit organizations. I've just met them, although I'm very excited about the work that they have been doing. I actually represent a sort of grassroots movement that started this weekend. Thousands of emails have been circulating the Twin Cities and Minnesota State. People who practice the modality and people of citizens who have been receiving these services are concerned, and these are the concerns that I'm bringing to the table for them. Okay. First of all, the scope of practice outlined in this bill covers every aspect and future possibility of the natural healing sciences. It includes every application and therapy practiced by every natural health care professional. Okay, this is important to us because some of these practices require years of specialty education and training. Whereas I respect the education and the credentials of the people who are presenting this legislation, and I surely want to honor them and respect them in some form of registration or licensure in the future, I am concerned that their 4 years do not cover all that their scope of practice claims. A medical general practitioner doctor, if you were to ask him to describe his scope of practice, he would not say that my scope of practice includes surgery, oncology, podiatry, chiropractic, gynecology, psychiatry, pharmacy, etc. Okay, their scope of practice in the natural health community appears to us to include each and everything that all of us have spent many, many years learning and specializing in. Our clients that come into Healing Insights, less than 2% of them have ever seen a naturopathic doctor. We encourage them to do so. But again, the therapies and the people that I'm presenting are also very specialized in their own nature and way. And whereas we don't deny that the naturopathic doctors have some training and education in the form of classroom in some of these modalities they're naming, we do recognize the fact that they are not specialists in these areas, nor do they even practice some of the things that they are claiming in their scope of practice. Okay, recognized and respected practitioners of these modalities are concerned because the law paves the way into the future. We in Minnesota are proud of Mayo Clinic. We are proud of the Client Bill of Rights. We are proud of the way they are respected throughout the country in other states. I would like to see the future legislation regarding natural health care in Minnesota to incorporate all of the people who are the practitioners in this state have some input into this legislation, and to be able to provide a study group to recognize and realize the future, and to, instead of doing it piecemeal, to do it all together and take a look at the larger picture. When medical doctors first went for their legislation, it was not a simple and quick process. I respect everything that's been done here to date, but I do request that we stop, we listen, and we find another way to approach a more comprehensive study. As a business owner, I know that the more thorough I am planning a new policy or procedure, the less expensive it will be for my business, both financially to implement and in reputation with my clients in the future. I urge this committee to consider this point. Thousands of people using these products and therapies could be affected financially, and so could the laws and maintaining the laws regarding these issues. And I thank you for your time. I think I ran over.
That's okay, Ms. Murphy. Who wishes to be next? State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gregory Schmidt. I am president of the Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. The Legal Reform Project understands that there's a lot of emotion surrounding Senate File 1520, the registration for naturopathic doctors. Regulation of these proponents has been discussed on and off at the legislature frequently over the last 15 years, but going back as early as 1909. Since the informational hearing held in the House Subcommittee on Licensing in March of 2007, I have made repeated efforts to convene a meeting between the Legal Reform Project and the Minnesota Association of Naturopathic Physicians to come together to solve the serious contentions that are in play. I have not received a cooperative response from their organization. The Legal Reform Project has proposed many creative ideas over the past 12 years that have not been accepted. Now, citizens from all over the state are contacting our organization asking for more public discussions on this topic. We think this could happen, perhaps over the summer when the tensions have eased and when legislative deadlines are not looming. This legislative body can play an invaluable role in directing the parties to come together, and along with interested stakeholders who wish to weigh in on the discussions, to come together and create a compromise that addresses everyone's concerns before further legislative action is taken. This bill is not an emergency. There is no urgent call for registration either by the public or by any current regulatory body. Indeed, the review of this proposal by the Council of Health Boards submitted to the legislature per the requirements under Chapter 214 state on paragraph 2. There are considerations that are not addressed for which the legislature may want to request additional information or clarification. We share their concerns. Specifically, the proposed scope of practice also does not contain sufficient information to establish the unique character of naturopathy as opposed to other occupations with which it overlaps. The use in this review of the term naturopathy, which is in the public domain under Chapter 146A, is interesting since the proponents have argued for the term naturopathic medicine. If the Council of Health Boards is uncertain about terminology, how is the court or other regulatory bodies to interpret this? There are at least six other areas that the Council Board review mentions that I'd be willing to share, but in the interest of time, I'll just mention two. Quote, the legislative proposal, if enacted, would remove the licensed, registered in this particular case, practitioners, as well as those who cannot meet the established criteria from the jurisdiction of the Office of Complementary and Alternative Practice in the Department of Health. Cases that would have previously been under OCAP will be referred to the Board of Medical Practice. We're not certain who those they are referring to are. Is it other naturopaths, traditional naturopaths, people of the other healing arts? So this is an excellent report, and it raises many questions. And finally, the proposed regulatory scheme is more in the nature of title protection, unquote. Do we actually need to move as though there is urgency when we are speaking about legislation that at this point is addressing the desires of 25 or so people? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. We are, that is pretty much the entire 10 minutes. If you were, I know there's
like
one more testifier.
Waive my time, but there's one person that would like to testify on the financial piece, and I will waive my, what minute I may have remaining if I can, Senator?
Yeah.
Thank you.
State your name for the record and give us your minute.
Yeah, my name is Boyd Landry, and I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for Natural Health. And I just sort of, in Washington, D.C., and I flew in this morning, so I took a look at the fiscal note, and I sort of took my computer out and a spreadsheet and started plugging in numbers and started trying to see if the information that was presented in the fiscal note made any sense. And I sort of made and you have a copy of my letter, and on the last page is the spreadsheet that I put together. And assuming that there are 26 people, which that is the number that has been used, and they each have to pay a $200 application fee and $150 renewal fee, that only comes to $9,100. So assuming that that's the case, you need an extra $3,900 to meet the first year's fiscal projection of $13,000. And that means you need to get an additional 11 people to register. In the second year, assuming those same 26 people renew, and you picked up an additional 15, and I'm being really liberal with these numbers, by the way, and I'll explain in just a second, you would only come up with a total revenue of $9,150 with a shortfall of $7,850. You would need an additional 22 people to register in order to meet the required $17,000 listed in fiscal year 10. And then 2011, $19,000 in expenditures. You picked up an additional 11, which would give you a total of 52. You'd end up being $9,000 short. Kansas is the only other state in the union that has a registration program for naturopathic doctors. It took them 5 years to double their registration pool. They started out with 8. They now have 16. Minnesota is roughly twice the size of Kansas. And so I gave the benefit of the doubt, and I said at the end of year 3, you would be able to double the pool size of registrants, and you still don't have enough money to meet the expenditures. And so this being the fiscal committee, I think it's important that you take a good hard look at these issues. And with that, Mr. Chairman or Madam Chair, I'm done because I think we're out of time.
You are.
And I can answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Okay. And Senator Torres-Ray. Are there any more questions for Senator Torres-Ray?
Madam Chair and members, just for clarification, the fiscal note was prepared by the Board of Medical Practice because they are the ones who actually look into this and do these projections. I assume, I'm not very versed on this process, but I assume that will be reviewed here by our staff in terms of kind of fiscal accuracy. And I am not very versed as to how that will work, but I assume that will be taken
care of. Well, we always assume that the fees are set to cover the costs. And sometimes when we do these things, the fees do not cover the costs initially, but they do over a period of a few years. In this case, it looks to me like the fees will pretty much cover it initially. Any questions? Senator Sharon.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I was wondering if either of you could speak to some of the issues that were raised around scope of practice being too broad and beyond what was reasonable in a scope of practice with the level of education that's proposed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, please go ahead, Doctor, if you would like to.
Well, being a family physician, I have to disagree with Katie Murphy on her testimony that because, in fact, doctors, we do come out and we are allowed everywhere. We are allowed to do urology and cardiology and pharmacologic and all the things. And that's the whole point of a broad-based family physician. And the thing is not – the boundaries are within our own domain of whom do we refer and when do we refer, but we have to know about all those topics and all those subjects and all those areas. And, in fact, we do practice within all those areas. It's the same for the naturopathic physicians. They're trained in all the things that's in their scope of practice. And I would see them at times choosing not to do certain areas. They may do first aid homeopathy, but of course they won't be fully 4-year qualified homeopaths. Doesn't mean they won't do homeopathy, just like I do some cardiology, but when people have heart attacks, I turn them over to a cardiologist. When people need more homeopathy than the broad-based general homeopathy, they would refer to a homeopath or a same with many other things. But the average family physician, naturopathic physician, is a broad-based person who's trained and has the ability to do parts of all of those things and has to make the decisions of when someone else would be referred. And many of them, for instance, would not do the kind of work and expertise that Katie Murphy, who testified, is doing in colonic hydrotherapy and would refer appropriately to people in her network, I think. So I don't agree with what she said about that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon, the amount of education that these folks have is the same as a medical doctor. The difference is they have a different internship. You know, the internship for an MD is different. Residency requirements are different.
Madam Chair and
Senator
Sharon
Coring.
Madam Chair.
Just wanted to clarify that
I have.
Wanted to respond to Senator Sharon, Senator Coring. Okay. But
Madam Chair, I guess I just wanted to. I thought the chair was going to focus solely on the fiscal note. It seems like we're getting into policy now.
Well, anyone on the committee can ask any question they want, Senator Coring. Senator Sharon, did you feel like you got your question answered?
Yes, I did. I just wanted to have an opportunity for there to be a response to what was said in the testimony.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair, I don't have a question, but I'd like to move the bill.
Okay. Senator Prettner-Solin has moved that Senate File 1520, as amended, be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
All right. Senator Day.
Madam Chair and members, thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing our bill 3638, which is about Steele County Nursing Facility in Owatonna, Minnesota. And I have with me some people that know the issue inside and out, and I think I'll turn it over to Commissioner Tom Shea from Steele County Commissioner.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Thank you for taking the time to hear our initiative today. Steele County is one of only 7 counties in the state that owns and operates a nursing home facility. And I'm very proud to say that we are profitable, meaning that we do not have any direct property tax subsidies going to our facility. We're able to do this because we have strong community support, strong administration, very dedicated staff, and a great volunteer program. But that being said, we also understand that given the current environment of nursing home funding, that's not sustainable, and we will not be able to continue to make that claim in the years to come. So rather than wait for a crisis situation to occur, Steele County is taking the initiative to develop an alternative. And what we're proposing to do is to downsize our 108-bed facility, which has historically been at 100% capacity, to 80 beds. Now, we can only do that if we have a strong community initiative. And we did undertake a community-wide asset map of services within our community. And our initiative is based on developing this continuum of care based on all the assets we have within our community. We think that this project is strongly aligned with the DHS 2010 and 2030 initiatives and that seeks to downsize facilities. To accomplish this, what we are proposing to do is to create a community-wide, a community nonprofit corporation to own and operate the new facility on the healthcare campus of Mayo and Alina in Owatonna. And we have invited, we have partnered, proposing to partner with the Benedictine Health Systems to manage and administer this facility. This legislation and the amendment that Senator Day has to offer would combine these two pieces of legislation into one vehicle. And I would ask, with the committee's indulgence, to hear from Kelly Harder. And
I understand that the fiscal note does reflect the amendment because you've shared it with the department.
That's correct, Senator. Thank you.
Are there any questions about the amendment? Senator Coring moves adoption of the amendment. If there are no questions about the amendment, then we will vote on the A1 amendment. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, good morning. And committee members, my name is Kelly Harder. I'm the Director of Human Services for Steele County, and thank you for the opportunity. I want to refer you briefly in my brief testimony to this document I believe they handed out. What's important that I want to leave with you today as you make this important decision, and thank you for your consideration of support, is that I went out and tried to cost out with public dollars what our aging services cost in our county. Because in reality, this initiative is more than just about a nursing home and a nursing bed, when in effect, we have to look at the whole continuum. And the whole continuum is what starts with a consumer. It also goes to the payer, the provider, and also the healthcare organization. And once we fully integrate all of those and we look at our continuum, not just in how do we deal with nursing homes in isolation of a nursing home, but we need to look at our whole continuum. I would add on, there's a total dollar on this continuum, which is very high-level, rough estimate. We would need to add approximately $20 million to that because I did not hear back from our clinic on their exact dollars, but roughly add $20 million, so it really should be about $67 million. And if you look at the continuum, the area where we have the least amount of providers but the highest cost level of care happens is on the, in our perspective, on the wrong end. We would like to move it down. This initiative creates the opportunity for what I'm already started to do is sit with developers and our assisted living providers and talk about how we do assisted living without walls. How do we move healthcare that primarily happened at the clinic to the nursing homes? How do we move it from what happened in the nursing homes to the assisted livings? And how do we have assisted living? Some might say, well, how do you do that? Well, they have to contract with us. And they contract with us, and we have some new assisted livings where I have them go around town and see what they have. And then I say, now, how are you going to niche develop to meet our needs that we have for some physical conditions that you might not have thought you wanted to do? If you want a contract, you need to do that. And they're stepping up to the plate. We now have home care providers providing higher levels of care and keeping individuals in their home and their community beyond what they've ever been able to do before. So at the end of the day, this is about not just a nursing home bed. This is about moving long-term care where we need to be moving it, which is in the community, but it's done through authentic partnerships with the counties, private organizations, reputable providers, healthcare organizations, and hospitals. And we're having meetings right now at the table where we're all sitting together and not how do we compete against each other, how do we work better for the consumer at the end of the day. I will close it by this and to say this has really created some unique challenges within the system, not only human services. I cannot say enough about the Department of Human Services, how they have really stepped up to help us with this. And at the end of the day, we all feel hamstrung that we want to do an innovative pilot, but current policy and current the system doesn't allow us to factor in some of the variables we want to do. And so if we're going to move the system forward so we don't have the same old dialogue in this room and others year after year to fix a system that feels like it's not getting us where we want, we would ask for your support with this pilot. We believe we've put enough safeguards around it so that we can prove it out and it could potentially become the vehicle statewide on how we revolutionize how we provide health care. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, you know, I know you have a time, you know, maybe if the committee has questions, we can save you some time, and I know you got a lot of people waiting in the wings here, and, you know, we'd be glad to move on as we could.
Senator Day, I see this project that your community is working on fitting in so well with the same idea that we're trying to move people with in terms of the health care reform bill. New partnerships, trying to get people out of the deep end of the system, trying to do a better job of providing those primary preventive services in the community. And so I'm so glad that you are here with this bill, because I think it will be one more way that we help, your county will help lead the way for others.
Madam Chair, thank you.
On the bill?
Madam Chair, I would just inquire about what does the chair want to do with this bill? Move it forward or lay it over? Or I'm looking for the appropriate motion.
Well, the reason the bill was here was to determine if it had a fiscal note.
Uh-huh.
And apparently they're closing enough beds and moving enough beds, mm-hmm. and they have the whole thing structured so it's budget neutral.
Mr. Godfrey's got a...
I should just make my correction on the fiscal note. There's something incorrect.
There's something incorrect on the fiscal note, so we will need to talk about the fiscal note. Ooh. Before we can do anything else. All right?
Okay.
Mr. Godfrey?
Madam Chair, members, there's just a slight error on the fiscal note, and it involves the Department of Health's numbers here. This is a preliminary fiscal note, so the Department of Finance hasn't had a chance to sign off on this yet. But the actual, it's right now, on, if you look at the front page, it's listed in the summary as a net savings to the state government special revenue fund of $3,000. It actually should say it's a net cost of $3,000 to the state government special revenue fund. And that's because the cost is associated with a decreased number in licensing income coming into the Department of Health for the beds that will be closed during this time. However, it really shouldn't affect the ability of this bill to move forward if the committee wishes to send it on to finance. Since this is state government special revenue fund, there's a surplus in that fund, and it can be appropriated.
Well, and we have nursing home beds close all the time in the state, and we don't usually get warning to have a fiscal note on it. So, you know, this is a pretty small change. Are there any questions? Fiscal note?
Madam Chair, if there's no other questions, I would make a motion that 3638, I believe that's a number, be recommended to be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Good
Madam
luck
Chair
with your project,
members,
gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Michelle.
I think is the amendment.
Do you first?
Is the amendment drafted?
Not yet.
Madam Chair, the amendment is on the press right now. One of my thoughts was, Madam Chair, I know Senator Lori has an amendment that we could take
right
up first, and I think we are just minutes away from having the language that
all
we're
right,
looking
for. All right, let's take the...
Madam Chair, I have the A7 amendment. While that's being passed out, maybe I'll just start to describe the purpose here, and I have worked with the author and with the Department of Health on this issue. What it really is with all these additional attention being paid to swimming pools and whatnot, there is one category that has historically not received much attention, and that is sand bottom swimming ponds. One of my cities, the city of Cloquet, has one of these. It's kind of a man-made body that is a sand pond. that is currently not functioning. They need to repair it, and the Department of Health has never really regulated these in the past. But again, with all the public attention being paid to swimming pools, they started wanting to look at these things. So Cloquet got in a little bit of a fix with a question as to whether they could even actually move forward and make the needed repairs to make this thing functional. And so what this amendment would do is to exempt these sand bottom swim ponds. The department doesn't really even know exactly how many of them there are in the state today. They want to take a look at them as we go forward, but we want to give Cloquet the flexibility to make the repairs to this and put it back in operation and become one of the group of sand bottom ponds that the department is looking at. So, one thing to make very clear is that that it does not exempt any sand bottom swim ponds from the requirements that are being put in place regarding the drains. So even if Cloquet does move forward, they would move forward in a manner that addressed the concerns regarding the drains. And then this whole subdivision would expire in June of 2011, which would then allow the Department of Health the time to review what they want to do with these, but give Cloquet the flexibility to move forward in a manner that they choose to. And I'll just add, it's not even a foregone conclusion that they will repair this. They may replace it with a full-blown pool. I don't know, but they would. There's a lot of members of the community that would like to repair this. It's kind of an interesting and unique community asset that they've had for many, many years. And so this amendment, I've worked with the author and with the Department of Health. I think that it's pretty widely accepted as a reasonable measure to accommodate everyone's interests.
Are there questions about the A7 amendment? Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, if I could ask Senator Laurie for a brief explanation about a sand bottom pool. I just don't know. And Senator, my great friend to the left of me doesn't know either what I asked or what it was, so.
Senator Coring, for purposes of this subdivision, it's an artificial body. There is a definition of it in here. It's an artificial body of water. It's like a swim pond, but it's sand lined. I mean, it's actually, you look at it and it's like a beach. It's sand and it goes down gradually.
Chair, don't they call that a lake?
Well, Senator Coring, not really. I mean, if you've ever seen them, it's sort of a sloping sand that goes from the ground down in, and then it has, concrete walls to hold the water. Mm-hmm. And so when you walk into it, it's like you're walking into a natural area. But it obviously would have different drainage requirements than a regular concrete pool.
It has drains,
Madam Chair,
and circulating equipment and whatnot. And so that is a pretty distinguishing characteristic between this and a lake. It is an artificial body. It has a sand.
Is it, Madam Chair, then is it kind of naturopathic? Or?
Yes, but highly trained.
Okay, that's
any
all
other
the questions
on
I
the A7 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the A7 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
I just wanted to thank Senator Laurie for working with us over the past couple weeks. I look forward to the field trip to the swimming pond.
Well, and I should note, this is an olive branch that the cake eaters in Edina is holding out to the lumberjacks who they beat in the hockey tournament just a few short weeks ago. So this is.
So we do have a couple of other bills on our agenda. So.
We're not going to talk about that now.
If the other amendment isn't quite ready yet, maybe we can just set this aside again for a few minutes.
I don't see Ms. Kavanaugh, Senator Berglund.
And we could call on your colleague, Senator Dill.
These
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for giving me a hearing on this bill. Members of the committee, Senate File 2884 is a bill that deals with four nursing homes that have recently been sold to the private sector. They have been municipally owned. And in the process of that sale, there's a future problem in the way they're going to be reimbursed as it relates to pensions. The four nursing homes that I have in this bill are two in my district, Burns Manor in Hutchinson, Lakeside Healthcare in Dassel, and then Senator Vickerman has one in, I believe it's Lakefield, and that's called Colonial Manor Nursing Home, and the fourth one is in Senator Leroy Stump's district, Pennington County. It's called Oakland Park Communities. There's a fifth nursing home that's in Senator Sharon's district, which is in the same situation. I believe her bill is coming up next. But in order to describe the details of this reimbursement issue, I have with me the administrator for the Burns Manor Nursing Home in Hutchinson, Linda Kranz, on my left. And on my right, I have Bill Ward, who's been the administrator of the Dassel Nursing Home for 27 years. And I'd like to have Bill Ward further explain the details of this.
And before we move to the testimony, I just want to let members know that the fiscal note that you have for this bill in your packet is incorrect. It is a dated fiscal note, and we are having the correct fiscal note copied now. And I would also just like members to know that we don't have the general fund money to cover this bill. So it'll be a decision that you make as to whether we send this on to the Finance Committee, knowing we really don't. I mean, we'd be spending money in the next biennium that we, according to all best ways of thinking about it, we don't have. And so I leave it up to you. If the bill is forwarded to the Finance Committee, it would be my intention to send a letter along with the committee report indicating that the committee felt that this was an important enough issue that we should forward it to the Finance Committee, even though we do not have a way to cover the cost. All right, thank you. Why don't we take your testimony then?
Madam Chair, members of the
committee. Identify yourself for the record.
My name is Bill Ward. I'm administrator of the Lakeside Healthcare Center in Dassel. Some of you have already heard our story, so I'll try to keep it fairly concise for the members who may not have heard already. Some history on this. All government nursing home facilities have been subject to PERA in the past and had that PERA cost as a part of their daily rate assigned to the facility. A 2007 law change defined the process for establishing the PERA portion as subtracting out the former year's PERA and adding back in the next year's so as to make the cost a pass-through to reflect legislative changes in mandatory contribution levels. It was a bill with good intentions, but unfortunately bad unintended consequences. The law did not anticipate a change of ownership for a facility. Each of these four facilities, and in addition the one in Gaylord, had the good fortune of moving from municipal ownership to non-governmental ownership. It was good until we found this problem. All have found it after the fact. The 2007 law was passed after the sales had already been arranged. The future problem that's now faced by our employees is that where we have prior year PERA costs, those will get subtracted from the rate. Where we now have no new PERA costs because they've been replaced with 403B or 401K plans, there is nothing new to put in. New pension costs don't count. Therefore, there is no historical non-PERA costs in our rate because at the time those were established years ago, we didn't have non-PERA costs. We're now caught with pension plans that are essentially eliminated. I did provide to each of the members a handout, it looks like this with the black stripe on top, as a tutorial. Essentially, there's two line items on here that I will point out. Line one, which is the old math when facilities were public, And line 3, when the math under the new language proposed in Senate File 2884 is passed, if it is in fact so, the costs are, in these examples, which are only examples, would be identical. So all we're asking for is that we treat these as they were in the past. The bill simply then treats our new 401k or 403b plans as if they were still PERA and retains our pension systems intact. This is not the first time this is done. It was also done for the city of Lake City in the year 2000. Some comments on the cost. The Department of Human Services has issued a fiscal note that indicates there is cost to the state. It needs to be understood that the fiscal note assumes the reduction that would now be required by law and then counts in its report the costs of returning it back to no harm done. So it really is not new money. There is no new money being requested. The funding mechanism is the money that will be subtracted in the same math formula that adds back in the other half of that portion. Actually, any potential cost savings to the state from holding firm on this law are not even reflected in the present state spending projections because the cost reports that we are identifying this reduction in have just begun to be filed and are still in the process of being looked at by the state. So officially, the state can't possibly know that this reduction is even coming until sometime later in the year when those cost reports are processed. And in fact, the program likely will actually be cheaper because employees under the 403 and 401 plans tend to choose a lower participation rate, so we expect the cost in each of the facilities to drop to some extent just for that very reason. It's our position that the state will actually save money on this, even if it's passed. So what we're simply asking is that we fix this at this point because it's so easy to do and there is really no new cost for it, and allow us to continue to count our pension costs the old way and keep our employees whole. I can't imagine that anyone in this room would tell us that we should cut our employee pension plans. It's too easy a problem to fix to even entertain that thought, and we respectfully request your help in fixing this. Thank you.
Are there questions? Senator Prettner-Solon.
I think, Madam Chair, probably a comment, because certainly I agree with you that you should get this changed. But on the other hand, each of our nursing homes in our districts have all these special situations where there are similar problems. And sometimes it's the reverse. I have a nursing home in my district where it went from a private operation to a public operation or a nonprofit operation, and the private operation had not invested in the nursing home for so long that it was in dire need of replacement, repair, upkeep, and everything. And because of that, they were set, it was at the time that rates were established, they're set at a level that is $17 daily below every other nursing home in our community. So, and they're in desperate need, and I have not been able to get any type of relief for them. So it's hard for me to vote for another nursing home that I understand has a desperate need also when I see the same type of situation or at least a similar desperate situation in my community.
Well, and I understand that we did this in 2002. When we had a budget surplus. As far as I know, we have a budget deficit for our fiscal year 09 and fiscal year 10 and fiscal year 11. So that's my concern, is when we do this, we just need to think about what we're going to cut to pay for it along the way, because I believe obviously we would have to cut something to pay for it. Now, if we think it's important, then we cut something to pay for it. If we think it can wait until another day, then we don't.
Say, Madam Chair?
Yes.
I was just speaking with Mr. Godfrey, and he was suggesting that if it would be more palatable for the committee and for you, Madam Chair, to wait. He was suggesting that on the fiscal note, on fiscal year 09, to shift the $6,000 that's shown in that column over to fiscal year 10,
try would you to get be through. Moving all the numbers one column, or would you just be adding the 6 to the?
Well, I think Mr. Godfrey was talking about moving the 6 to fiscal year 10, if that would make things easier to deal with.
Mr. Godfrey?
Madam Chair, members, the idea here would be to have the cost reports for the two facilities that have already reported costs that are counting in fiscal year 09 to move those reports to their rate adjustment to fiscal year 10. And so the numbers would be fiscal year 09, 0, and then adding 6,000 to fiscal year 10 for a total of 54. And then the fiscal year 11 number would be 131,000.
Senator Dill, it doesn't matter to me. We don't have the money in 09 or in 2010. So whichever year we're trying to pay for it, we would have to cut something, whether we're cutting this year or next year. We have a tails. We have tails targets that we, you know, we have tails we have to worry about as well in our budget reduction bill, as well as this year in terms of budget reductions. So,
Chair, I think Mr. Ward here has a comment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the other handout that you got was a photocopy of Lakeside Healthcare Center's rate notice that shows the actual math. If I could draw your attention to the area circled as we're talking about finding money, it graphically shows that the money that we need for this bill is already in a future cut. The bill self-funds itself. There's no place else you have to find new money. The number in here shows $2.29 taken out last year and $4.03 put in to the rate this year. In other words, it's just a flip-flop, one out, one in. Those numbers, the $2 is a very old number, so don't get hung up on the fact that it's a large difference between the two. In our next cost report, something in the neighborhood of $4.03 will come out, and something in the neighborhood of $4.04 will go back in. It's a wash, and it's all done. Just wanted to make sure.
I understand that it's a wash on your end. It's not a wash on our end. That's the difficulty here. Are there any questions about the fiscal note? Senator Sharon.
I have a question for your Chairman Berglund. I just wonder, I'm just seeking your counsel, would it make sense to, because my bill, which is the next one up, is essentially the same, that we simply amend the Gaylord Nursing Home Project to this bill and address it at the same time?
It might be. I mean, you're both in the same situation, and you both have fiscal implications to your bills. I scheduled them both because I know that, and
they're essentially the same.
Wouldn't be fair to schedule one and not to schedule all of them. So maybe you'd like just to set this aside for a minute and go to your bill. Maybe before we do that, is your amendment ready? All right. Well, why don't we take Senator Michelle, since he's been so patient.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. After additional discussion, there is an A-10 that has been drafted. Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner Solon moves adoption of the A-10 amendment to get it before us. So within 2 years of the required dates, is that the 2009 date, or is that a different date that's in the bill?
It's 2009 and 2011.
2009. That's the 2009 date.
Or the 2011.
Or the 2011.
Madam Chair, John Stein of the Department of Health, if I could just clarify. The 2 years applies to the dates on line 2.16, which is January 1, 2009, and the date on 2.21, which is January 1, 2011, as amended.
And, Madam Chair, this language has been shared with the Minneapolis Parks.
So this would help all the communities that might not have this expense budgeted in, and it would allow them then to have a plan for getting into compliance, so we have one standard, but we give them more time to work it into their budget. Is there any question on the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. And are there any more questions about Senate File 2833? Senator Prettner-Sullivan.
Madam Chair, I'd move that Senate File 2833 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to full finance.
Mm-hmm. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, now Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. I'd like to offer an amendment to, is it 2884.
Do I need to go up there to make the amendment?
I could use some help with this as well, but that after number 4 on line 2.6, or after 2.7, we simply add line 2.8, number 5, that would read a facility in Sibley County license for 54 beds as of August 1st, 2007.
Okay. So you've heard that motion. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. So now we would just kind of take these two fiscal notes and put them together. So what is your pleasure, members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would say, even though we don't have the money for this in front of us or in the near future, that these sort of equity issues are so important for nursing homes. I think everybody at this table has a real special place in their heart for nursing homes. I would like to move these bills, and even if they just circulate cyberspace for a while, at least they're alive. And if we come upon any money at any point in the future, or at least sit down and address all the tremendous challenges that the nursing homes across the state face. I mean, they're popping up here and there all over the place. Senator Prettner-Sullivan just mentioned one in her district. These nursing homes as an industry, and we're well aware, are in dire straits. Rather than not passing the bill, I'd just soon pass it and keep it before us, even though we don't have the money to attach right now.
I'll take that as a motion.
Move to finance.
So moved.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And I think with that, the meeting is adjourned. And I believe this is our last meeting for this year, members. Thank you for all your good work.
Still think you had a good idea.
Unless we come up with something.
Still think you had a good idea.
Yeah. Well, they can try it in finance.
Yeah.